The original legendary alternative business guru himself, author of 6 best-selling books, regular presenter on BBC TV and radio. Hello and welcome to the Practical Leadership Podcast. I am your host, Paul Morton, and we are talking about leadership, management, and the various lives that surround it. It's my joy, delight, and privilege to bring into my studio some of the smartest, wisest people I've been able to find for your delectation and enjoyment. And I hope that you do get a lot out of the conversations that we have here. When you realize that your management team has grown too fast, or you've inherited a new team, and the fastest, best lever you have for growth and improvement is attached firmly to those managers, get in touch. I help you run management, coaching, and training programs that'll make a big difference really quickly. You can find me at the Practical Leadership Academy website and on all the usual social channels. Jeff Birch, thank you very much indeed for joining me.
Hi, how are you?
I'm cracking. All the better to be talking to you today, Jeff.
Adoring fans will be following me with burning torches and pitchforks, I should think. You should either be a glowing example or a terrible warning. And I lean towards the terrible warning.
Oh, there, but for the grace of God, go on.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
Right back to minutes. Oh, superb. Tell my both of my listeners then, Jeff. Tell us all about yourself. Where are you from? What's the story here?
I'm a business guru.
You are the business guru.
I go around the world guruing to various people. I speak at conferences, big conferences. I'm not sure anybody ever listens to me. I'm probably the most miserable person in the world. If I smell flowers, I look for a funeral, you know? I was brought up by an old, bitter-tinted Viennese psychiatrist, my dad, and he had a terribly bleak look on mankind, and I've got it too. And so I do see a lot. I'm passionate. I hate that word. Oh, God, I hate that word.
Enthusiastic.
I'm enthusiastic about management and business and everything else. But I could see the flaws in it. I know that if people make the correct changes, their businesses will flourish. But I have to mask it a bit with humor, because otherwise I do deeply offend people. So it's a humorous gallop through how crap management actually are, really.
I don't know sometimes if we get the managers we deserve.
Yeah, 100% we get the managers we deserve. I mean, that's...
questions, you know?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, absolutely. I created this model for the Sheffield Teddy Bear Company, and we haven't got the time to go through all of it, but it works on this very simple idea that This mythical teddy bear sells for 100 quid, and it costs damn near 100 quid to make it. No, that's fine. It does. That's how the economy was in the 1960s and 70s. And then some bright spot discovers that in China, you can have these teddy bears made for £1, you know, and so they immediately move all product. They lay off all their skilled people into the eye forgers and the plush manufacturers and the seamstresses and the K-pop spreaders are all fired. And this company goes from some weeks when the teddies cost £101 losing money, and the weeks when teddies cost £99 making money, and they sell, well, I don't know, 1,000 teddies a week. So they're making 1,000 quid a week. Now they're making £99,000 a week, you know, because they're shipping the stuff in from China. They devastated the town's economy, but on the whole, the guys who own the teddy bear factory are doing very well. And then the government's saying, well, you've got an awful lot of money. We ought to have some of that off you. In fact, we'll have a lot of it off you, you know. So what they do then is they build this glittering building next to where, when they've demolished the manufacturing, they build this glittering building. And they fill it full of HR managers, production designers, marketing, telephone sanitizers, everything, to gobble up this spare £99,000 a week. Now, the people in the town are saying, oh, look at those hands. They're crippled from forging glass eyes for those teddy bears. I don't want my children to be like that. I want them to be managers. So they borrow 60,000 quid to go to some crap university that used to be a quick... and come out with a business degree where they go and work in forward production management or, you know, strategic planning for the teddy bear business or something. And it all kind of worked until the Macclesfield Teddy Bear Company, who've done exactly the same trick, realized that there's, because they're only paying £1 to make their teddy bears, they could sell them for 90 quid. So the same happens until they get down to selling teddy bears for 2 quid each, and have both had to lay off all their office staff who have no actual skill in life at all. So it does worry me a bit that we're managing bugger all and not making anything, which is the kind of key to it.
I love that. I love it. Starting with HR, I've been working and selling to HR and learning development people for years and years.
Yeah.
And some of them are magnificent. And if you're listening, you are one of the magnificent ones.
Yeah.
But the
vast... All my clients are the magnificent ones as well, by my note. The ones who pay me.
But the most of these roles that you're talking about, they're like self-fulfilling prophecies. You put something in place with a job title and a budget, and all of a sudden I have to fulfill some need, whether the need is real or not.
Yeah.
And well, poor bugger then is paying X over the odds for it and suffering the stains and arrows of outrageous process.
Well, I love the word process. I created this, another one of my fantasy stories, this idea of arming the peasant.
Love that.
And the idea is that the old king or duke or whatever he was died. He's a fairy tale king and he dies. And the frog prince, who's been a frog up until now, until some idiot kissed him, goes to the treasury that's packed with gold, but isn't, finds half a biscuit and some mice droppings. So immediately, now he's in charge of this organization, but by birth, not by intelligence, decides that what he really, really ought to do is get the consultants in. So he rings Machiavellian, who come and do a learning curve exercise and send him a huge bill, which he can't pay. But they come up with this idea of agility, lean, and a flat organization, you see.
So he says, well, the management.
Yeah, and he says, well, what's all that mean? He says, what you do is you're carrying this massive, massive cost of the head office or the castle, as we call it. You've got ladies in waiting. You've got footmen. You've got the kitchens. You've got the night, the money your night spend costs. Unbelievable. Get rid of all of them, every one of them. You're going to flatten the organization. We're going to empowerment. So what we're going to do, the peasants do all the work, you get the money. Peasants, money, work. So the peasants can have a subsistence thing that they've always had, and then you get all the profit. Flat organization, you see. Brilliant. And this works wonderfully, you see. Wonderfully. Until he realizes that the baron next door is actually still working on the old principle of having lots and lots and lots of soldiers, which he hasn't got anything to do. They haven't got anything to do. He's spending a huge amount of his money from his peasants on this standing army that have got bugger all to do. And in fact, might assassinate him, right? So what he does, he starts gathering the troops Putin-wise on the border, ready to invade. Which time our prince panics and goes back to the consultants who hand him another large invoice and say, you see, this is what the key to this is now. Is empowerment. When you have a flat organization, you have to have empowerment. And he says, well, what does that mean? And he says, what it means is you arm the peasant. Okay? And he says, well, oh, bloody hell, they hate me. I seize their virgin daughters. I enslave their children. I'm not giving them guns. If I give them guns, they're going to shoot me in the ass. You know, that's the first person they're going to shoot is me. And this is like business organizations with empowerment, you see. No business really wants to give power to their staff because the staff hate them and they could get up to all sorts, you see. So what happens then is that the consultants go, no, you see, this is the clever part about this. You give the peasants guns, but you don't give them any ammunition. So they...
Genuine empowerment, empowerment.
They look at so you have like these wonderful things, like these NPS scores.
Oh, good grief!
Yeah, I know. So you have this dreadful experience, and you ring this poor creature in a Swansea call center, And you say, can you refund the money from my terrible holiday? And she says, no, I can't. Why not? I'm not allowed to. I can't. There is an appeals process, but it's way above my head. I can't do anything about it. And you go, oh, well, you're a bit crap then. And she goes, well, I'm not crap. I can't do anything. I'm not allowed. So, and then she says to you, because she's reading off a sheet, is there anything else I can help you with? So when you ring off, you get this robot ring up and say, could you take a few minutes to fill out the survey? You know, which you score like 1 to 10. But if you give her a crap score all the way along the line, but it's not her fault, then the company says, you know, we have failing staff. We'll go and give them a good kicking, you see, without actually giving anybody any power to do anything. So you know, the word I got a boss when empowerment was really fashionable. It was about 20 years ago. I got a boss ring me up and say, I've read this Tom Peters thing. You know, this excellence. They were, we're going to be excellent. I want you to come here and do a project with us, uncompromising excellence, obviously within a very limited budget. But I want you to empower my staff, you see? And I said, well, empower them to do what? And he said, well, I want you to empower them. Empower them to what? To move us into the 21st century through empowering teams. Teams, that's it, teams, empowered. And I said, what do you want me to empower to do? And he said, I want you to empower them. I want you to empower them to do what they're told. So, you know, I literally drool with excitement when I read things like the Toyota manufacturing method and stuff like that. And then I see how British managers can so distort that the whole point of it is completely and utterly, you know, we could be so good, but businesses aren't British Western businesses are more interested in capital, return, investment, profit. They don't really bother, or they don't really understand productivity and engagement. They don't. And that, you know, they keep talking about it. I mean, I'm an old hippie, a genuine old hippie. I'm a biker. I've got about 10 yards from where we're sitting, I still have my Harley Davidson.
Magnificent.
Called Uncle Yui. And finally, I'll ride off into the sunset, you know. But I'm in the film Easy Rider, they're sitting around the campfire smoking something that you shouldn't be smoking. And one of them says, they talk and they talk and they talk about individual freedom. But then when they meet a free individual, it scares them. I don't think anything has changed from there at all.
There was one point in time where the old maps in the schools were all pink and written hand in the morning, right? I mean, I'm just about old enough to have the leftover books, all the leaders of the empire and stuff.
The Raj, yeah.
Exactly. So at some point, we weren't quite pathetic. At some point, we sailed ships around the world, planted flags in people's toenails, and captured most of the planet and called it British.
Yeah.
At some point, we were actually fairly competent. And then we sort of, I don't know, just entirely lost the plot. Somebody had a good idea. We imported all this stuff. We imported
British food. British management has traditionally been crap. We have a large public. I am an old Hell's Angel, as I said, and I'm a biker, and I'm absolutely, I got expelled from the roughest school in the town, which is quite an achievement. But I am married somebody from Cheltenham Ladies College. And the bikers used to climb in at night, and that's how I met my wife. But one of the local public schools, I won't mention them by name, actually had a sign up saying that they wouldn't take children from trade. They didn't accept children from, they do now, they're all estate agents' kids there, but they, when I was a kid, they wouldn't take people from trade. And the point with it was, is that everybody with a British sort of tradition wants their kids to become gentlemen. I've just done a whole project with a German chemicals company, and sort of Otto von Stumpf or something runs Stumpf Chemicals, and he's like the sixth generation. Yeah, hello, Jim. And I said, what did you do at university? Well, I went to Hamburg University and I did industrial chemical science, you know? And what did your dad do? He went to the same university, did industrial chemical science, you know? What did your grandpa do? He was in the war. We don't talk about him. But, you know, he was, but, you know, that they have this kind of thing. But here, a local traveler family didn't get called up in the war. So started a metals business, you know, because in the war it was in great demand. And their grandson, somebody we know divorced their grandson. He wouldn't pay the divorce settlement. And in court, she proved that he spent $150,000 a year on his polo ponies. Yeah. So like in literally two generations, the desire is not for your son to learn chemical engineering, but to become a gentleman. And gentlemen don't work. So you get all of these chinless wonders inheriting companies and having no desire to get their hands dirty or even understand what the company does. So that is another problem that we have that perhaps continental people don't have, or Americans for that matter.
Well, I think the Americans are just getting into generational wealth now.
Yeah.
They're just getting used to generational wealth. They've had it for what, two or three generations?
Yeah.
Real wealth. I mean, you look at the nobody talks about this, but the multi-billionaires and the 100 millionaires in the US.
Yeah.
And then you come over here and you have people in the UK who have been wealthy womankind, right? Oh, yes, I own chain of
whatever. Scotland.
Yeah, that's it. What do you own? Westminster?
Yeah.
Oh, which means you mean the land? No, I don't. The government, it's mine, personally.
Yeah, yeah. They're always really nice people.
Oh,
I mean, they have this thing of the nouveau riche. We did this project for a business in Scotland, and there was a most delight. We're called him Georgie. Oh, hi, I'm Georgie. I own this bit. And he was so nice. And this lovely lady makes me my tea every day, don't you, Dory? And absolutely super. Do you fancy going for a pizza? I don't know. And he took us in this Subaru estate. He said, I can't sit in the front. I'm a real bloody dog at the seat, you know. And this filthy car, rusty and smelt of powder. And he says, it's ever so good having the business here, but it's only 50 minutes from my door. And I said to one of his staff, George's, she said, it's 50 minutes to his door. It's another 50 minutes up his drive to the castle, though. And he was the Duke of Abernathy or something, you know. But he was so under the radar, this guy. But you know, he's certainly, you know, yeah, old man. They I've always felt bad about the clearances, actually, which is, you know, Bonnie Prince Darling. I mean, he was a bastard, you know. I mean, Grandpa was right to kick him out. You
know? Oh, my goodness.
But they pride themselves in not understanding. Oh, this chap here, he looks after all our money. I don't have anything to do with the money. And for my misery and shame, both of my sons became lawyers. But my younger son, he was a hooligan. He's a barrister, right? And this is British through and through and through. In the back of his gown is a pocket. Every barrister has a pocket between their shoulder blades.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so the clerk can put the little bag of gold in there and a gentleman never touches money and they can't reach their money. It's all handled by their... So when they stand for you at the Old Bailey for you to be hanged or whatever, a little bag of gold is put in the pocket that they can't reach, you see.
That's a fantastic. I love that. I did not know that. I did not know. How then? I mean, if you're going around guruing,
yeah,
must have some hope and some idea for how do we go about fixing someone.
It has to be carrot, not stick.
It's because I think we forget our customer.
Yeah. And I think you can show companies how much money they make if they get it right. I mean, I hero worship and slight Disney, because Disney, for their kind of, whoa, you know, their uncompromising attitude to being Disney. But that compared to a fun fair that comes to your town, which is all they are, you know, the way they handle and manage their brand and the way that they kind of do the whole customer experience thing. It doesn't work in France because you can't make French people friendly, helpful and polite, but in California, I mean, in the state, it's stunning the way they do. And there are companies that stand out. You know, the ones that I mean, if you compare TUI and Jet2 came from nowhere, really, but they're eating TUI's lunch just because their customer experience, it doesn't have to be wonderful. It just has to be better, you know, and it is better. You know, you ring them up and they answer the phone eventually, but they do, and they will sort things out and so on and so forth. And I think their staff are given a certain level of power to sort of write off money and this sort of thing if they think that's what they should do. So, you know, the companies I work are companies who are capable of change.
It's been the idea of competition there. You look typically at people who do similar things to you.
Yeah.
I think that's kind of the wrong way of looking at competition. You end up doing the wrong things because somebody does something similar to you is in your industry, and you're from inside your world is looking inside somebody else's world in reality. Yeah. You're going to be looking at it from the point of view of the guy with the money.
Yeah.
The guy with the money is comparing his insurance provider with Tesco. His supermarket is comparing it with all sorts of random stuff because it's that moment of experience that the buyer has that they're comparing.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that I try to sort of, if you wanted to move quickly from Lyon to Saint-Michel or something, you know, whichever French town or whatever, one of the ways to do it is to race bicycle, right? So, in the Tour de France, all the people gather in Toulouse or whatever it is, and then they go as fast as they can to Lyon. There's maybe 200 of them, and some of them crash, but on the whole, 99% of them get there bloody quickly. And if you actually check the time that they did it, it's unbelievable the speed these cyclists go at. But if you've got somebody like Unilever or something, so we ought to get into this cycling thing. What we first need to do is build a bike that can carry 100 people, you know. So immediately you can see that this bike's going to be ludicrously heavy. And they say, oh, yeah, but percentage terms, you know, a 100-seat bike only weighs a ton. Now, if you compare that to the weight of all the bikes in the peloton, you know, we're cutting back on that. And the wheels are only 3 foot wide and a, you know, it's only about 20 bikes width, that is. And then they say, well, once this thing starts moving, we need to have a person whose sole job is to steer it, you know. And he's the only person who knows the destination of this bloody bike. Everyone else has to pedal uninformed of what the destination. And you know full well that if you're paid 20 grand a year to do pedaling, and the guy behind you isn't pedaling as hard as you, why should you bother pedaling? You know, so there's an awful lot of people who aren't really pedaling at all on this thing.
And there's a few people on there who are actually trying to row, and they're just like, what?
Yeah, and they don't want to tell
us. This is much better.
Yeah, absolutely. And they don't want to go to Lyon anyway. The whole point is that if you have an organization with genuinely empowered people who understand what the destination is, then the managers can step back. I mean, we're overmanaged. You know, that's the thing. One of the things with the, if anybody ever bothered to look at my arming the peasants thing, one of the things that happens is, like with the teddy bear factory, if you have an excess of wealth, what do you do with it? I mean, imagine the prince is not worried about invasion, but this money from these crops pours in. You know, that was the trouble with the lords of the manor. You know, they tithed the peasant. What'd you do with the money? Seriously, you're a medieval lord. You've got 1,000 peasants giving you 50% at least of what they grow. So you've got 50,000 tons of bloody grain every year. What the hell do you do? You sell the grain to London, the merchants of London, who give you bags and bags and bags of gold. What the hell do you do with it?
You put it in the back of the barrister's robe for a start, just for.
Well, yeah, some, but you have a. Well, you build a bloody big castle.
Mm.
Then you have a kid who carries a velvet cushion with your bog roll on it. And then you go and visit the lord next door, and he's got 3 kids with cushions with bog rolls on it. Because he's doing better than you. So the next thing you know, you recruit another 4 kids to carry the bug rope. And that's what managers do. They meet at conferences that I speak at and say, how are you doing? Oh, I'm doing well. I've got 25 in my team. And the bloke thinks, bollocks, I've only got 20 in my team. So the next thing you know, he built his team to 30. You know, I work with a well-known, what would you call it, broadcast. And they actually had this, they had too many people. They had sort of 800 staff and 80 managers. So they cut it to 400 staff, but they still got 80 managers. And they cut it to 200 staff. They still got 80 managers. So they're not cutting the managers. They're cutting the staff.
Who's cutting?
The managers, of course. Yeah, absolutely. You don't put yourself out of a job. But as I say, excess wealth, just general. I mean, I'm sure if you went, you know, I mean, I think people like Google and these sort of things are smart enough to spot this. They suddenly started culling their home office people, haven't they? Mm-hmm. I think it's dawned on them that the people who sit on bean bags and make oat milk coffee and generally
and
just
don't make
hang
anything
out,
else.
Yeah, wear khaki shorts and trainers. Actually, why pay them the money when you can keep it for yourself? But then again, you say, same as you said, this massive, massive wealth that they're generating. What are they doing with it?
Putting them in the pocket for later.
Yeah, and they're messing with the world as well, though, aren't they? They're starting to become political with a small p.
Yeah.
They're starting to do what they consider to be charitable things and so on. I mean, it's a bit scary.
It's one of the things I consistently vote against whenever you get the shareholder vote things through. Consistently vote against these big companies because it's in the articles, you know, must have a renewed agreement that we can make political donations. And I say, well, no, because you're a company. You don't get to do that. And yes, they do to millions of...
Well, I think it goes beyond political. I mean, people like Microsoft and stuff, they go beyond that. They do their own direct interfering. You know, they don't bother with politicians. You know, when you've got more money. I mean, there's a famous story that Steve Jobs ends up in heaven, as we know, dragging this enormous sack behind him. And St. Peter said, what are you doing? What's in that sack? My worldly wealth. And St. Peter said, no. This is heaven. You can't bring it with you. Anyway, how much is in there? And he said, $500 billion, I think. And Peter says, well, look, step in. I'm sure we can do something.
It is the self-fulfilling prophecy. The minute you put people in position with a title and a budget, they have to do something. This is something, so this is what we have to do. And
yeah.
This keeps on going and going, and you eventually can't get fired. You can't get rid of it. Until somebody comes along and fires three quarters of Twitter, and nobody notices. That's the terrible part. Nobody notices. I think there's many people there's lots of nonsense jobs out there, especially in middle management.
Yeah.
And they're just nonsense. In some part of your head, you know that I'm completely pointless. But I'm still busy and getting paid a ton of money.
Yeah, well, I'm not there. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, have you ever met?
And she said, but there were people there who said to her directly, I've got 5 years to go. Don't rock the boat, basically. Because she was slashing and shouting things out and, you know, how do you cut costs? And somebody come up and says, don't rock the boat. I've got 5 years to go.
Yeah.
That was okay.
Well, the politics, I mean, I've got another fantasy company called the Golf Ball Company. And if you go to a bloke on a machine on the factory floor, you say to him, what are you doing? He says, I'm making golf balls. And you go to the chief executive, what do you do? We make golf balls. But if you go to somebody in middle management, ask what you do. They say they're curating the brand. What about golf balls? What about golf balls? You know, you make golf. Oh, do we? You know, it's like, really? That's not what they do. What they do is internal politics, messing around, meetings, just generally parting about. They're not making golf balls. I mean, there's only the people at the either end of the business are making golf balls. And of course, then you have this thing, you can make the golf balls anywhere in the world. Yeah, that's another scary aspect.
It's a race to the bottom.
Well, yeah, but there is hope. I mean, the hope is that the businesses can see the genuine. The problem is we don't put trust people. You know, we don't trust. So I was trying to sell this idea. One of my clients had the most appalling customer problem. And I said, well, the problem with it is it's it festers. The customer's process for putting things right is so long that they grow the problem in their head. You know, that the fastest way to solve a problem is to knock it on the head quick. I said, the installation engineer ought to be given a pocket full of cash. And if the customer isn't happy, they just give him a handful of cash and the customer will shut up, you know. And that the look of horror. Are you suggesting we give our engineers cash? Yeah, you're a loony. What? Boy, what would happen if you give them cash? They bugger off with it, that's why. You know. Well, what sort of people are you employing? The sort that would bugger off with our cash. Well, if you can't trust your people, then you're recruiting the wrong people. If you are recruiting the right people, then trust. And the other thing with that is I love this idea of, you know, the bicycle, as you see, there's a single, energetic person doing the job and getting on with it and making decisions. And there was a government thing where if you're in the most terrible financial distress, you can go and appeal and they can give you an emergency money thing, right? And I mean, it's really quick. It only takes, and we said, well, how? Again, I wish we had an hour because I remember in a manufacturing company, they had a 30 weeks delivery for something, for a pump. And I said, well, what takes 30? I said, I suppose if you've got design, engineer, test, you know, a pump, it might take a few, but 30 weeks. And they looked at me again like I was a loony. And they said, what do you mean, test manner? They're here. I said, what do you mean? He said, the pumps are here in the warehouse. And I said, what takes 30 weeks? It does. You know, it does. And it was the same with this emergency loan. What takes 10 weeks? Well, it does. And what is it? Well, the applicant obviously doesn't have the correct paperwork. The member of staff who processes the original application hasn't got all the facts. Then it moves up. And of course, the whole thing is, this is taxpayers' money, so it has to be secure. It's security. Now, the main thing was about a lack of trust. That the girl on the counter, who's not stupid, knows the difference between a wino and a woman who's been abandoned. Do you know what I mean? She's got a good sense of her customers alike. And if she judges this person is in real trouble, she could open the drawer, give the woman 30 quid, and shut the drawer again. They said, yes, but you see, there's a matter of trust, honesty. And I said, look, if you put a child in a locked room with a chocolate cake, one child, one chocolate cake. When you get back and the cake's gone, the kid's got chocolate all over his face. Who nicked it? You know, the more people you've got in the process, the more opportunity for untrustworthy behavior, not less. You know, so I'll know, because then what we do is our supervisors are all supervised. Ah, but who supervises the supervisor? It's this huge sort of expansion of stupidity where, again, if you look at the industry that you talked about in the times of empire, a lot of the businesses were run by dictators. Herbert Austin, Northcliffe of the papers, all these people were terrible old tyrants. And a lot of the decisions they made were wrong ones, but they were making decisions and they stuck to them. And on the whole, they drove these companies forward. You know, now we've got committees and everything else. Nothing ever gets decided. Nothing gets sorted. It just trundles on.
There's a guy called Townsend who did some stuff on decision making. He worked out, it was also based on some athletics results, sports results, that a good hitter in golf, baseball, stuff like that, and a good manager, if you get 1 in 3 hits decisions right, that's really quite good.
Yeah.
One in 3 will actually be diametrically wrong. And 1 in 3 won't matter.
Yeah.
So if Northcliffe is making 3 decisions in a day and one of them is right, pretty good.
Yeah, because the returns pay for all the wrong ones. You know, I mean, again, people will look at past mistakes and say, we're not doing that again. You know, and again, so they find a settled way of doing it. It's a bit crap, but not as crap as some of the mistakes they've made. They just trundle along in a slightly crap way. You know, it's like the kid who walks on this sort of icy pond, fell through the ice. He'll never go on ice again. Say, well, no, sometimes it's thick enough to walk on. Not catching me out like that again. You know, it's that same thing. I just have run businesses and found that the frontline people are a lot sharper than management. That they hide it on purpose. I remember in that sitcom Bread, this very sharp bloke who was the father of the family was a road sweeper who did something incredibly incompetent. So seen by his boss. But the mother, who was the boss of the family, shouted up the road to his supervisor, you hired his aunt, not his brain. Which is, you know, it's such a British statement that. This idea of malicious obedience, you know.
Oh, yes. Passive aggressive. We're masters of that.
You want me to, screw that on there? Yes, do it. Okay. So when the water come pissing out through the wall, didn't you realize there was a, well, you told me to screw it there. Yeah, I knew there was a water pipe there. You didn't ask me about the water.
This is where the carry-ons come from and all that sort of
stuff. Oh, well, of course, again, this idea of, this hilarious idea of the British worker who, and again, I have the same issue with Dilbert. You know, everybody loves the Dilbert cartoon. You do not want a Dilbert working for your business. You don't want a Dilbert organization. It's a nightmare. Well, yeah, the whole Dilbert is just as bad as his boss. You know, Dilbert undermines all the time. He isn't particularly bothered about it. You know, it never explains in the Dilbert cartoon what the business actually does. And he doesn't care either. You know, none of them do. The only intelligent one is the dog, you know.
And, world domination.
Yeah. I've got my message across humor. But whether anybody ever listens or takes it on or whatever, I mean, there are glittering prizes to be had if people manage businesses properly. Even sales is one of my specialist areas. And it's just simply just getting the most simple phone answering person just to do a little upsell, you know. I mean, McDonald's do it all the time. Do you want fries? Do you want to go large? Yeah, of course they do. And it adds some, it adds a vast amount to the bottom line.
It's a nice shot. Have you got the belt?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. The batteries, you need the batteries for that. Something there. Stuff like, you know, and yet we're scared of giving power to our people in case they string us up. I think that's the other thing, the peasantry involved.
Mm-hmm.
You know, again, the unarmed peasant, you know. Was everything all right with you or me or no?
Oh, good. That's nice. Thank you for coming.
Yeah. Or you know, please call again. Is there anything else I can help you with? Nothing.
Evidently not.
But again, I say this, and you'll agree with me, and everybody agrees with the whole audience, that complaints are useful. The NPS score seeks to hide complaints, you know. So what the staff is doing is trying to make you give them a high score. They're not trying to learn where service is failing, which is the whole point of doing it. Does my bum look big in? Is everything all right with your meal? Are two questions that would not require an answer, you know, because there's nothing. But really,
you can ask something like, how could we have done better? Yep. Even if you think you've done a great job, how could we have done better?
I got a gasp that took the air out of the room to a room full of restaurant owners when I said, you ought to pick the customer up by his throat, pull his nose to yours and say, are you seriously telling me that this is the best meal you've ever eaten in your life? And they were, well, we're not going to ask the customers that. Why? Because our food's crap. We know it. We're not going to ask them that. And they said, well, the best food you've ever eaten in your life would probably be Manoir Quatre Cent. And say, it's not saying that is your aspiration. So, like, come on. There must have been something. What? Well, it was very nice. Nah, come on, I'm not there. What? Well, the chips could have been hot. Oh, really? Okay. So you go, so the waitress is empowered to go to the kitchen and say, do you know what? I've had a few chips not quite hot enough. Brian's the new lad, isn't it? Well, what I do, everybody has chips. Everyone has. So what I do at the start of the evening, I put out 24 plates and I put chips on every one. So, you dickhead. But like, that solved the problem. You know, that makes sure that everybody gets hot chips from now on. If nobody gets told off, nobody gets shot for it, nobody gets a whack it. So.
What's the one thing that you want to leave as a man as you leave this? Probably not mine.
Employ people you trust and then trust them, I think, is actually, you know, genuinely, you know, it isn't all you. I mean, it is. Yeah, put your trust in others. And again, so many people feel they can't, don't they?
Yeah.
I think a final story about, because this is supposed to be about managing, isn't it? My brother, who's an idiot, unfortunately he's no longer with us, but he when he was alive, he was an idiot. He's punctiliously exact in everything he did. He would, you know, this business of a cake, You know, you want to let one kid cut it in half and the other one choose. Cut and choose. Do you remember? You know,
children, we do this.
Yeah. Well, he was told to do that by my mother. My sister, who's a rebel, he got a vernier and measured the cake and scribed the center. And then it divided it so that literally to the molecule, half and half. Right? But my sister licked both halves and said, I don't fancy either of them, and left him apoplectic. Anyway, he joined the RAF, right? So he went off to learn how to be an officer. He went off to wherever it is, their big college. And the weekend, first weekend, they're greeted by the wing commander. And they're told, all of you have come here to learn to be officers, but we want you to settle in as well. So this weekend is free. You can go to the village. You can go and enjoy yourselves. And then the real work starts on Monday. But just to get your kind of juices flowing, while you enjoy yourselves and settle in, here's a little exercise. You've got a 60-foot flagpole, 400 meters of wire rope, 36 tent pegs, a sledgehammer, a winch, a Land Rover, a troop of six men and a sergeant. How does that flagpole get erected? I want to know on Monday, but don't knock yourselves out. So some kids did it on a backpack. Another one got an exercise book. Another one wrote it on the back of his hand. But my brother did. He went to the village. He had a leather binder made, a gold embossed flagpole project. And he did diagrams, bloody angles and this and that. He had pages and pages of step-by-step instructions. So the Monday came, they're all sitting there. And the fag packet bloke is treated with complete contempt. You know, the one with the back of his hand told to go wash it off. And so on it went, and there's my brother glowing, right? And the squadron leader, the wing commander, just picked his beautiful leather folder up, threw it straight in the bin. And it's like, he was so upset. And he said, follow me. So they all went outside. And there's a squadron leader there. And there is a 60-foot flagpole, the wire, the stick, the whole thing is there. And the wing commander says to the squadron leader, he said, remember, you are here to be officers. You are here to be leaders, managers. Squadron leader, show them how it's done. And the squadron leader stepped up, hands tight at his side, and said, Sergeant, sir, erect that flagpole, sir. And that was the end of the exercise.
On that, we will finish. As outstanding. Jeff Birks, thank you so much indeed for joining.
Thank you.
And that's a wrap. I hope you enjoyed the show. Thank you for joining me. If there's ever anything I can do to help you on your journey, then do please reach out. You can find me on LinkedIn and all the usual sources. Do please subscribe, leave me your 5-star review, and most importantly, get in touch with your comments and feedback. It's really how I grow, and that's what I'm doing this for. Thanks again.